Monday night edition of the pod brings another nail in the coffin to my playoff predictions as the Utah Jazz go up 3-1 off of two dominating victories over the Oklahoma City Thunder in Salt Lake City. This one was not even as close as the final 113-96 score indicated. The Jazz, with really an offensive victory, I think that's been the first thing I'll point to in this series that's been most disappointing for OKC, is their total inability to stop what was an average Jazz offense this year. I haven't cared for their strategy. I haven't cared for their execution. We knew that there was a chance they would struggle offensively. Why haven't they been able to stop Utah?
It has been a strange mix of scheme failure and execution failure. So in this one, there were a few times where you're sitting there going, why is Joe Ingles so open? And a couple of those times it was later in the game, especially in the second half, because Russell Westbrook picked up his fourth foul in the second quarter. Actually, they put Russ on Ingles, and so he lost him a couple times.
That was even
ball.
The case.
That's
the,
a little
that
bit
was even the case
to me.
At the end of the second quarter when he hit the three threes. I believe right. that all three of those were when Westbrook was guarding him. But that wasn't even necessarily the foul trouble, because like closing out on a shooter, you should be able to do that as well, right?
Oh no, I'm just saying because Russell Westbrook is bad at defense.
Right.
Like, you know, he loses guys.
Well
he
did, no.
Like
to, you're being too harsh on him, Danny. He did. He picked up Ricky Rubio like twice full court. Like, what are you talking about? He's great at defense.
Yep. And that one time he played good defense on James Harden for like 10 minutes. But I mean, it's hard because that is certainly a part of this story. And, you know, Melo's limitations, there were points when Utah was going after him as well. That was not really the 3-point defense. That was more Donovan Mitchell getting drives. But overall, just Oklahoma City, I mean, it wasn't as egregious to me as in game three when they were just leaving that corner open and Rubio was getting the ball there, or they were getting it to Gobert or whatever, and they were getting it. It wasn't that egregious. But it's just producing too many. And other than Donovan Mitchell, and Donovan Mitchell was wonderful in this game, we'll talk about some of the stuff that he did, Utah's one-on-one creators are not so dangerous that you need to be selling out to stop them. A lot of the time, you know, Rubio is a nice passer. I like a lot of what he does. But you trust your own players to not get beaten one-on-one, and the Jazz aren't going to do that much on that end of the floor. They can be wonderful defensively. Maybe they can get out and transition a little bit. But I've been shocked at how scared OKC has been of penetration and of their creators.
And Donovan Mitchell, okay, I get it. He's maturing into an excellent finisher, right? You play him 2-on-2 in the pick and roll. He gets going downhill. He can score over you. Has Ricky Rubio made one layup in this entire series in the half court? Like, I don't think he has. And yet, you know, they send him left every time. And Steven Adams is all the way out to the three-point line. Make him pick up his dribble. And then in game three, you mentioned they changed the scheme. They had the weak side corner man going all the way up to basically like plug the roll man at the free throw line. This time they weren't as aggressive with that. But Ricky Rubio, I mean, you're playing directly into his strengths with that coverage because he's got good size at the point, and he can bait you either to go back out to the corner and then you're going to give up alley-oops as they did right at the start of the third quarter when it was Westbrook guarding the man in the opposite corner, Ingles. And then, you know, they got two alley-oops, one to Favors, one to Gobert, because Westbrook didn't want to jump in there and get a foul on those alley-oops. Or, you know, he'll bait you towards the roll man and then find the guy in the opposite corner. Mitchell has started to be able to throw that pass as well. But again, you know, if Mitchell, he could pull a three off the dribble, he's looking better with that. Although, you know, I still would live with that shot until he hits a few of them. Rubio is not going to pull a three off the dribble when you go under on him. So maybe try going under or just conventional fight over the screen. And you've got Steven Adams waiting back there and play it 2-on-2 and make Ricky Rubio make a layup over at least a semi-decent contest. And they haven't even tried that in this series. You know, all right, you try it, you get beat, I get it. But didn't really make a ton of sense to me.
Beyond the idea of trying it and getting beat, what Oklahoma City's doing isn't working. You know, you can get the idea of, okay, well, you try something until it fails and then you try something else. This has been failing for most of four games. I mean, OKC did win one, but they need to do a lot differently. And there's an argument to be made that OKC's defense has a significantly lower ceiling without Robertson just because of personnel, but he wouldn't be papering over all of these miscues.
He'd be helping a lot. And I thought that they have looked their best in this series. You know, middle of the second quarter was the best that they looked in this game. They actually led it 30-24 after one. And then the highest number of points they put up in a quarter after that was 23, which was a struggle. They're below a point per possession yet again in this series. But I thought the best they looked was with Grant Durant at the four. They're able to get him finishing around the rim. They're able to get some activity, some offensive boards, some block shots. I mean, that level, when we've seen OKC's defense be at its best over the years, even going back to the Kevin Durant era, but now even this year, you know, you remember that game that Melo got the sprained ankle in Oakland and they turned over the Warriors a million times in early February and won. You know, that was Grant. And now, of course, Carmelo Anthony is Carmelo Anthony. And we've talked ad nauseum about how they need to find someone else, namely Grant, to play at the four. But, you know, because he isn't doing anything offensively, he's 5 out of 18 tonight. And 11 points on had one free throw attempt. And then Grant actually gives them something defensively. He gives them something in transition, some momentum plays. But, you know, they feel like they can't go that way. I was very curious to see if this game was close down the end, whether Donovan, to save their season, actually would go in another direction from Melo. But it wasn't even close enough that it became an issue.
Yeah, you're right. I hadn't really given it too much thought, but the idea that coaches know what their best lineup is, what their best configuration is, and only go to it when they absolutely have to, that we didn't get that opportunity. And Russell Westbrook, you know, I mean, there are a lot of different things to say about him. And I don't like some of the revisionism. Again, this is a point we've talked about before, but it's worth repeating, about how this season is some sort of referendum or something silly like that on his MVP year. His MVP year was basically, if you get 100% outcome for Russell Westbrook, things can go really well.
He was much
well.
Better last year. But in this game, he's not the same player that he was last year.
And in this game, Westbrook, 5 shots in the restricted area, made 3 of those. 4 shots paint non-restricted, made 2 of those. 2 of 6 from mid-range, missed all 3 of his threes. And he didn't get... He got to the line 11 times. That, you know, so he ended up with 23 points on 24 shooting possessions. Also had 3 assists, which was actually the team high because OKC only had 10. Oof. As a team. And Westbrook had 5 turnovers. And one of those remarkable stats, I think you and I both noticed this on Twitter, Royce Young tweeted out, there were only 13 potential assists for Russell Westbrook in this game.
Yeah, which is a very low number for him, a potential assist being a pass leading to a shot attempt that, had it gone in, would have registered as an assist. So it's really just too hard for Westbrook when Rudy Gobert is on the floor at this point. And they tried the Patrick Patterson thing in game 3. They had some temporary success with that. They didn't really go back to that much to try and match Patterson up with Gobert this game. Patterson wasn't able to do very much. Paul George had maybe the worst 32-point game that you can remember. 6 turnovers for him, 5 turnovers for Westbrook. That was they combined for 11 of the Thunder, 14 turnovers. George was trying to work in pick and roll a lot. Wasn't looking great. He was getting stripped a fair amount. Only had 2 assists. He did manage to draw 12 free throws, but that was really the only thing that saved his night, particularly 2 of 9 from 3. And as a team, the Thunder were 5 out of 26. And maybe if they hit a few more shots, they could be in this game. But who on this team are like these great shooters? You know, Abrines was 2 for 2. There's nobody else you look at. It's like, oh, old reliable 3-point shooter just wasn't going in for him. Carmelo is not a reliable 3-point shooter any longer. He's 0 for 6 in this game. And now we've been focusing on OKC this entire time. And part of that is because there is an expectation both for them this season and coming into the series as the team with home court that they were going to be more competitive. And perhaps they still can be. 3-1 going back home is not quite the death sentence that it is when you're on the road and you're still facing 2 more road games in the series. But the Utah Jazz were 27-5 over their last 32 games. And they're showing exactly why in this series. Donovan Mitchell has one of like the 4 or 5 highest ever rookie scoring averages through 4 games in the playoffs. Rudy Gobert, 16 points, 4 offensive boards. He killed them on the offensive glass in this game too. And then of course he was plus 19. They just cannot get anything around the rim when he's been in there. And there's points made by me earlier in this series, just not necessarily a point, but just a, hey, you know, let's watch this. This has been a good data point for Gobert in the idea that he really is that valuable player, that he is a top 15 type of player, because OKC has been totally shut down. And while the Jazz have a lot of good defensive players, and I think that's a big part of why they've been successful, by the way, is they really just don't have any weak links on this team. That Gobert, of course, is the heart of that. He makes all of those guys in the perimeter a lot better. And if indeed indeed they go on to beat the Thunder, I can't wait to see how the Houston Rockets attack Gobert and this Jazz team in the next series. That is going to be absolutely fascinating.
Okay, this is pretty remarkable. I looked it up, and for the series, so, you know, we're only through four games. This is admittedly small sample size theater. When Rudy Gobert has been on the floor, 27% of Oklahoma City's free field goal attempts have been in the restricted area, and then 10% from floater range. When Gobert has been off the floor, 42% and 14%. So the attempts are an absolutely massive part of that. The success rate is actually pretty similar on restricted area shots, but if you basically have their role in the offense, that's going to nuke most teams' efficiency, especially since the Jazz historically have had a low foul rate with Gobert on the floor.
Yeah, and if you're a three-point heavy team and you can get off threes and hit them, or if you're, you know, the Golden State Warriors, one of the greatest mid-range shooting teams of all time, you can get away with not getting that much at the rim. Or maybe you can actually draw Gobert away from the rim every once in a while. But that's easier said than done because he does have a lot of mobility as well. But the Thunder clearly are not the team to do that. And I suppose we should talk about the result of the "I'm going to shut that shit off" Russ comments. You know, he didn't play that well. Rubio was plus 22 in the game. He also drew all four in one way or another of Westbrook's fouls in the first half. And I laud Donovan, not that he had a choice. Westbrook probably would have thrown a fit if he'd been taken out. And he finally did sit down with the fourth foul. But, and hopefully that doesn't mean that more teams like don't go to leaving a low foul player in the game. But he first, like, he inadvertently tripped Rubio. Then he was trying to pressure him up full court and just like Rubio just stopped and he ran him over. That was the second foul. Third foul was a total phantom call where he actually hustled back after being under the rim on offense and just completely destroyed a Rubio shot from behind and somehow got called for the foul. It should have been Abrines, who was the primary defender on Rubio on the play. And then the last one was Rubio taking what looked like a pretty legit charge on him. And Westbrook did end with five fouls. He should have fouled out because he threw Rubio to the ground on an offensive rebound later on after taking a really weird Euro foul on Jay Crowder, which eventually led to Crowder's ejection, as Crowder just for no reason started like yelling at Westbrook and then ended up forearming Steven Adams in the face as Adams ran up on him to pull him off of Westbrook. But yeah, I thought Crowder, maybe if the game were closer, didn't deserve to be ejected, but because it was a 20-point game with 5 minutes left, it was like, let's just send a message by ejecting this guy and, you know, avoid further altercations and make sure everyone gets home safe here. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty embarrassing for Westbrook and the team to perform that way with all the shit that he talked.
Well, yeah, and there was a lot of that weird, feisty stuff once the game was already basically settled. There was also the talking that happened after Rudy Gobert got hit in the beignets. Brent Berry, great call. And I think what was so weird about that was that there was some talking between Gobert and Westbrook after that because he was kind of gathering himself. And to give a double technical was a little bit strange. Refs, I think, have gotten overly reliant on the double tech because it's a result that for whatever reason they maybe feel people won't complain about. But it is often not an equitable result. It hasn't really lingered too much in terms of these like accumulations or anything like that. But I feel like there might be a reckoning on that coming at some point. And I just think it's lazy officiating. You know, not everything deserves equal punishment both ways.
Yeah, I agree with you. I also thought that Ingles, who was utterly annoying Paul George by just touching him all the time, Dylan Murphy had a good tweet, and I completely agree with it, that one of the things you can do as a defender, Dellavedova is great at this too, is just touch a guy all the time and just see how annoyed he gets. And Paul George certainly got very annoyed by that. He got a technical early, but then Ingles got another technical trying to like take the ball away from George after George just like lost the ball into the backcourt, but didn't really seem to be doing much. But there's no way George was going to get his second technical in that situation. And that was really the beginning of the huge Jazz run, was the end of the second quarter. Westbrook goes out, and for all we've crapped on his game, he still had a much better plus minus than the team as a whole. And they really got beat during that period as the Jazz took a 6-point lead, outscoring them 34-22. But you knew it was going poorly for OKC already because they were giving up a lot of open threes, and the Jazz missed two of their first 11 threes in the second quarter, and then Ingles hit three in a row. But they had been some pretty good looks for them. So game five now. you give the Thunder any kind of a chance here? It sure seems to me like the Jazz have been so clearly the better team.
I definitely give OKC a chance to win game five. There'll be the emotion of it. And Utah, you know, they can have cold shooting nights. I think Utah's defense has been miles better than OKC's over the last few games in particular. But, I mean, that would really, to me, just be delaying the inevitable in all likelihood, because Utah is the better team. They have been the better team. The momentum, as it were, in this series, like the inertia I'm really struggling to come up with an analogy here. It's just struggling in that direction. I mean, I would be very, very, very surprised if this goes seven. And so it could go six. I believe that. But OKC, like, we saw how much, you know, that was a Herculean effort by Paul George. A lot of things went right for OKC in their win. And then other than that, things have largely gone Utah's way, and the Jazz have earned that.
Yeah, these losses have not been particularly close. I do expect OKC to play with more intensity and defend, although you have to imagine it'll be a little bit of a weird crowd at home with the idea that if they lose, Paul George is probably gone. They're all happy about this renaissance this year, you know, under Russ, and what's going to happen to this team next year if they lose. No one expected them to lose in potentially five games, so you could see the crowd experiencing some nerves, to be sure. So I don't know how much home court advantage they'll necessarily have compared to the normal OKC crowd. Utah certainly had a hell of a home court advantage in these last two games. You could see them winning game five. I think the Jazz need to come out and at least like make it close, though, and serve notice to OKC that, like, okay, maybe you won at home, but you didn't find something. You know, don't do the 2015 Clippers, we're just going to get blown out on the road in game five and just assume we're going to come back home and win it in game six, because you know, things, you only have one shot. Anything can happen. Just ask those Clippers, just ask the 2016 Thunder about that when you're the road team with a 3-1 lead. But I largely agree with you, because I don't think that there's anything that OKC can solve here. You know, maybe it's Westbrook just being even more aggressive and just getting hot for mid-range. Maybe Melo can hit some shots every once in a while. George could go off again. You know, like, they are capable of winning games, but the problem of Gobert, of getting efficient offense, I mean, I don't see where that comes from other than Hero Ball. Maybe Steven Adams could get Gobert into foul trouble. He had, I think, a total of one offensive rebound in the two games in Salt Lake City. Like, he needs to be a lot better in 35 minutes than one offensive rebound. I think they could maybe try some more of those Adams post-ups on Gobert, which maybe try to get him into foul trouble, or see if Adams could just score on him, which he actually has done pretty efficiently. He had two beautiful left-handed hooks early on in the game. And I think, obviously, you know, whether the will exists to do this, but, you know, less Carmelo, more Grant. Josh Huestis, I think, is probably going to play more now. Corey Brewer has not given them anything from three. You know, he's only getting off 2 3-point attempts when he's not really being guarded, you know, you might as well just go with Huestis. And I think maybe your option here is just try to play this to a scoreless tie and be there at the end and hope that your closer can come through. I think that's really, but, you know, that doesn't, I'm sure you're not wowed by that strategy.
There was an interesting quote from Isaiah Thomas on NBA TV after the game. He said, this is referring to the Oklahoma City Thunder, in listening to them talk, I sense that they don't seem to understand why they're losing, and strategically they haven't figured out a way how to attack Utah and how they can win the basketball game. And I think that's a pretty astute interpretation, and I think that's a criticism both of the players and of the coaching staff, because the coaching staff hasn't been really willing to go to some of these wholesale changes that have been pretty glaringly necessary.
I thought they tried stuff in game three. It wasn't necessarily what I would have tried. I thought they were too aggressive in the pick and roll coverage, and Snyder and the Jazz coaching staff and the Jazz ball handlers, Ingles, another guy, are just too smart for that kind of hyper aggressiveness to work. The Jazz, you're going to a strategy that gets beaten by moving the ball, and the Jazz are one of the best teams in the NBA at moving the ball. You know, I think more switching maybe could work as well, especially they went to more switching towards the end of the third. I think whenever they've got Exum on the floor, you know, go ahead and switch, because they usually have, and Rubio is totally switchable, especially anytime Mitchell is out of the game. I think you can go to a lot of switching, or if they've got Crowder in and Ingles out, that Crowder has not hit a shot in this series, basically. So then the Rockets have shown this, that when you switch, it's not even about the individual matchup so much as it is about being able to shrink the floor behind and the ISO that follows, even if it is against an inferior defender. But so those are things to try. But, you know, they did try like the Patterson thing. They've changed up. I still think the more conservative pick and roll coverage too, especially when it's Rubio. I mean, if it's Mitchell, fine, get your ass up there, pressure him, whatever. If it's Rubio, hell no. 2-on-2, make a layup on us. You know, the Rondo coverage, and frankly, the Rubio coverage that has existed for years, or go under, or whatever it is. But make that dude make some layups. He has not shown it in his career. He's been a little better this year, but he's not shown overall in his career that he can do that. And if he does it, then he does it. But that's the thing they haven't tried yet. Anything else you wanted to add here?
No, I'm excited to see how this game five goes, because while I have a sense of, you know, the end result of the series, what we see from Oklahoma City will be somewhat telling in terms of, I guess, something. I mean, I feel like Paul George, if they lose this series, it'd be really hard to come back, because the getting Roberson would be
if
help,
you go to
like,
the Lakers,
what would
even
he be coming back
to? The Lakers
to?
Even, you probably have a brighter future than staying there in OKC.
Yeah, especially with their financial flexibility, which OKC does
right.
not
and
have.
And, oh, Roberson is going to come back. Like, all right, calm down. Like, this idea, number one, that he's like a defensive player of the year candidate seems a little bit too far for him. And number two, he's coming back from a torn patellar tendon, which is not exactly the easiest to come back from. And still, if you get into the playoffs, he doesn't need to be guarded at all. So he's much more of a regular season player. And Paul George, obviously, is someone who wants to get there. I mean, you know Westbrook's going to come out with just a crap load of intensity. I mean, has he even had a good game yet in this series? Like, I don't think he has, right? So is it going to be focused, smart intensity? The indications from today would be no, but certainly he was playing at a very crazy way that, you know, does not inspire a lot of confidence in the rest of the team, especially playing on the road. To be out of control like that is probably not a great idea. All right, we'll get to Houston, Minnesota, and then we also got to talk some prospects here in the Southwest Division. It was a light night tonight, so we finally get a chance to get to that a little bit. Right after this, from Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club doesn't just have razors or shave butter anymore. They have shampoo, body wash, toothpaste, everything you need to look, smell, and feel your best. And really, there's no reason to be like going to the grocery store to get these items anymore. Number one, Dollar Shave Club, I think, gives you better quality stuff at a better price. And if you join their club, they make sure that you have all of this stuff on a regular basis. So you don't have to worry that you ran out of toothpaste all of a sudden in the morning and have to ask your roommate for some, or just not have any and have to just use Listerine. That actually happened to me a couple times in my youth. It's not gonna happen anymore now. And of course, you will get their amazing high quality shave every morning with their executive razor, and their Dr. Carver's shave butter is also fantastic. It goes on clear, which is helpful, so you can see where you're shaving and also, you know, make sure that you didn't miss any areas as well. So it's time to clean up your bathroom and your morning routine. Join Dollar Shave Club today, and for just $5 with free shipping, you will get the six blades executive razor, plus trial sizes of shave butter, body cleanser, and their one wipe Charlie's. Then you can keep those blades coming for a few bucks more per month. The way to get started with them, dollarshaveclub.com/capspace. Easy to remember that /capspace URL. We talk about it all the time here on the program. That's dollarshaveclub.com/capspace. The Houston Rockets scored 50 points on 26 possessions in the third quarter of their April 23rd game four against the Minnesota Timberwolves at Target Center.
14 of 24 from the field, 9 of 14 from 3, a perfect 13 of 13 from the line, no turnovers, just an absolutely ridiculous performance in a game that I was a little bit surprised at how close it was at halftime, just because I thought I expected the Rockets to hit a few more shots, maybe just due to gravity or whatever else, because the regression to the mean, or is that progression to the mean when it's they're below the
standard?
I think
it probably would be, yeah.
But yeah, progression to the mean. And then that all came in the third quarter, a lot of that driven by Chris Paul and James Harden.
Yeah, Harden and Paul, 37 of the 50 points themselves. Harden had 22 of those. They were going under on Harden DHOs, on Harden screens. He was just banging threes, making him pay every time. Amazing to think that Harden actually ended, or was over his first seven in this game, and the what's wrong with James Harden calls were happening. Also worth noting that the Wolves only scored 20 points in that quarter. They got outscored by 30 points in one quarter. Karl Towns did finish with 22 points, but he did a lot of his damage late once things were already decided. And of course, Tom Thibodeau ensured that there was plenty of time to do damage late because he left Jimmy Butler in for 38 minutes in a game that was a 30-point game after three quarters. They did hustle back and get it to 16 at one point. Good for you. And it's not like Butler has been injured or anything. In any event, we saw that the Wolves were able able to be effective to some degree attacking those switches by going quickly. I thought that Houston did not do a good enough job of shrinking the floor, and you saw right away in this game, even at the beginning, that they're going to do a much better job of that. PJ Tucker, who had a knee injury scare but appears to be okay later on, the first three drives of the game for Minnesota, Tucker is just standing right there in the restricted area helping off a Taj Gibson who only had 2 points in 20 minutes. They were not able to make Houston pay for helping off of him at all. Jang actually even hit a couple of threes. And ironically, with Towns getting in foul trouble right away, two fouls in like the first 2 minutes of the game, I thought it actually looked a little bit better out there. Their strategy with Jang as the defensive center, that's damning with faint praise to be sure, but the strategy of having Towns lay back in the pick and roll, they really started carving that up in the second, just were missing shots. And then the torrent finally was unleashed for a Houston team that must have been saying finally, and I think they hit every single shot that they had missed over the first three games in that third quarter, which was, by the way, one of the great historical quarters, maybe the best offensive quarter in NBA playoff history, in fact.
For a second, when you said the torrent was unleashed, I thought you were going to be talking about Derrick Rose's first half.
Yep, Rose actually finished 17 points, 7 of 11. He was actually plus 6.
Showed some
Derrick burst. Rose is plus 6 in a game they trailed by 30 after three quarters. But no, I mean, where I was trying to lead to on that was only one other team has ever scored more than 50 points in a playoff quarter. That was the 61-62 Lakers in a game that they actually lost. They trailed by 28 going into that quarter. But remember, of course, back then the pace was just ridiculous, right? We don't have specific possession counts from back then, but they took over 100 just field goal attempts in that game. So one would guess that the pace was much faster. And so the overall efficiency for the Rockets, and it's almost a 200 offensive rating for an entire quarter. It's 2 points every time you're down the court. That's just completely insane. They even more embarrassing for Minnesota, despite the Rockets hitting every shot. Every time they missed, it seemed like someone like Capella, who had 7 offensive rebounds and had 14 and 17 for the game, in addition to 4 blocks, was like out hustling them for offensive rebounds and then kicking it out for threes that they of course immediately hit. It was a pretty embarrassing effort from the Wolves in the third quarter, but you know, just this is one of the greatest offenses of all time, and it's good to see them finally get going to that type of a level.
And that lines up what looks like it's going to be a really intriguing series. Obviously both these teams still have to win one game, I mean, because Houston is now looks like they're getting a little closer on track. I'd like to see a little bit more from them in game 5, because you know, one quarter, even one half is not enough. But you mentioned it, I mean, Utah is playing incredibly well right now. These teams have very different strengths and weaknesses, and that could be, I don't necessarily think it's going to be a super close series. I still have to wrap my brain all the way around it, but I'm going to be excited for every single game of it.
I liked that D'Antoni gave Harden a little bit longer rest than normal, it seemed like. After he started 0-for-7, he took him out and it, like, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 minutes left in the first, and then didn't bring him back until maybe 4 or 5 minutes gone by in the second. And when he came back in, it seemed to kind of like reset him a little bit. You'll see Steve Kerr do that with Steph Curry every once in a while, like take him out earlier than normal if he's really struggling, to just kind of like get him to reset, get him a good rest. You know, Minnesota really failed in the first quarter to take advantage offensively of the really slow start from Houston, and then, you know, they obviously got blown out at the end. I mean, what do you make of Karl Towns? Again, he did a little bit in garbage time, but of him continuing to just fail as a post-up player in this series?
It's confounding, because I thought that was one of the competitive advantages Minnesota would have, especially with the switch heavy system. And Capella has done a wonderful job on Towns, which
he's blocked some of his jump hooks. Like, he's really been impressive. And I don't know whether Towns just hasn't succeeded in like getting his shoulder into him enough. And like, I thought he could really use his power and overwhelm Capella, but that has just not been the case at all. And he hasn't been able to score on Harden either, pretty much. You know, I mean, they're shrinking the floor, but it's relatively one-on-one. And it seems like he's really kind of just in his own head of like, okay, this, I have to get this type of shot, instead of just like playing basketball. And the one time that he got the ball and just went right away, he had a beautiful spin move on Eric Gordon and got a layup. But overall, it was just, he's really, I mean, I thought like, and it's, everyone's like, oh, no, post-game, he sucks. Like, no, this is the best post-up center in the NBA this year, as far as I was concerned. And it's just been shocking to see him struggle to this kind kind of a degree in the post, even given the lack of spacing around him.
One other note I wanted to make while we're talking about disappointing Minnesota young guys, Andrew Wiggins ended this game with 14 points on 16 shooting possessions. He made exactly one shot outside the restricted area, and it's good that he actually got in the restricted area enough to score some points in this game, but he just wasn't the same player to me that he was in game three. And it was certainly nice to see that, and I've been insanely critical of Wiggins this year, but I would say game four is more like what we have seen, at least so far, it can always change, than what game three represented.
Yeah, and while Rose did play well, they really missed Jeff Teague, who I think has been the one guy in this series who's been successful attacking on switches, just with his speed, getting into the lane and forcing help. Like, he really is at least able to blow by the initial defender on just about anyone who's been on him. And maybe he doesn't have the room to get the shot, but he at least is now contorting the defense and is able to potentially create something. But he had 5 assists in this one still, but was only 1 out of 7, negative 28 in 28 minutes. I mean, not much else to say on this. This is just Houston taking care of business. This is the Wolves not having the defensive players. I mean, I think Jimmy Butler had a good game in game three. I've been disappointed by his ability to create separation on switches. I always thought he was maybe a little overrated in that regard, but really he just like can't get by anyone. You know, like he's like getting into the lane, he looks like, you know, college Evan Turner, where he'll get in the lane, but like his defender is still between him and the basket, even if it's a switch guy. And then he's got to kind of go into this pivot and go to a fadeaway. You know, he does not have the burst that we've seen from him, you know, maybe 2 years ago. And even then, he wasn't like an absolute elite switch attacker necessarily. Sure, he's coming off the knee injury. It's been a while for him. He's got this wrist issue as well, though he actually, you know, I thought he's looked pretty good shooting like spot up three pointers in this series. But it's just, you know, he hasn't been able to get good shots. You know, I think that's just largely been the case for this Wolves team. Like, they have some good shot creators on this team. They're able to take care of that a little bit in game three. But I did think they got better shots too. I mean, like guys like Wiggins were getting open threes and hitting them. But Houston has largely shut them down. And when they finally got their offense going, it was just total lights out for this Wolves team, who it would seem the gentleman's sweep would be inevitable in game five. I don't know if we're even going to pod on that one, frankly, unless it ends. Because I think aren't there three other games that night?
Yeah, it's a part of that very frustrating Wednesday where not only are there 4 games, but it's 2 games played at exactly the same time and then 2 games played at exactly the same time.
Yeah, that's no good. They could at least stagger it. Like, the NCAA has learned that.
Like the NCAA tournament. Yeah, so that game is going to be at exactly the same time as Thunder Jazz game 5.
Yeah, and I think Thunder Jazz game 5 will clearly be what we will be focusing on for the Twitter NBA show, which I was forced to do alone today. I really got to enjoy that like 10-minute Jay Crowder review with nothing to talk about. But good to know you'll be back on Wednesday. We're not doing it tomorrow.
Hey, I asked you a good question. You just chose not to answer it.
Yeah, God, what the hell are they going to do next year? You asked me whether Kyle Singler would be the Thunder starting small forward next year. Yeah, he will inevitably be stretched, I'm sure. Oh, and actually, remember we were talking about that question the other day of like who would be the first player stretched this offseason? He's certainly a candidate. I think he's only got 1 year left now and then another like non-guaranteed year. So they can actually...
It's still Al Jefferson. I firmly believe it.
Well, I guess it depends when his guarantee date is probably pretty early. So I think that's probably why it'll happen. I bet you his guarantee date is... Let me look that up, actually. Guarantee date is... Oh, no. Actually, not guaranteed until the league-wide cutdown date. So I disagree with you. He will not be the first person stretched. I think it'll actually might be Cole Aldrich. He's got a super early guarantee date with only $2 million guaranteed.
Cole Aldrich's guarantee date is actually in June. I was working on Minnesota's offseason preview, so I don't know if that counts. Does it? If it's before the draft?
Yes. It was in the offseason, so I guess it does. I believe June is before July, so yes, that would count.
Boo!
All right, we're getting far field here. Let's do a read and then we'll talk the Dallas Mavericks prospects review for this season. I am lucky enough that I have never needed contacts, but I have known many people in my life who have, including my fiance, and it's always just seemed like an unbelievable pain in the butt to go and get your prescription, to have to go to the store and pick up new contacts like every month or whatever it is. Just seems totally miserable. And that's why I told my fiance about Simple Contacts when they wanted to be a sponsor. And so I'm like, here, you download the app, do their test real quick. She's like, oh, I don't want to do this test. Like, I'm like, no, here, you have to do it. You know, they want to be a sponsor. You got to tell us what you think of it. So she does it. And she's like, yeah, you know, that took me like 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes. Like, what was the point of that? And I was like, oh, well, actually, you just saved yourself an entire trip to the doctor. And she was like, oh, yeah, I guess that was worth it. It's nice to actually be right every once in a while about this stuff, since I so rarely am on these domestic discussions, shall we say. But Simple Contacts is fantastic. You go to the doctor, you're going to have an appointment, you're going to wait there well past the time of your appointment, especially if it's at the end of the day, you have to skip work. For only $20, you can renew your prescription with their online test. They test that your current prescription still helps you see 20/20, and then they renew that prescription. They still are going to say, hey, if you need a new prescription, you should probably go see an eye professional. And also, you should periodically see one to examine your eye health. But if you're just renewing a prescription, there's no easier way to do it. You spend the $20, and then you can just order your contact lenses for them. Their prices are unbeatable, and you just get them shipped right to you, super easy. Don't have to make a separate trip to the store. Best part is my listeners get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. Different URL here. That's Dunk, D-U-N-C, simplecontacts.com/dunk, D-U-N-C, or enter the code Dunk at checkout. The cap space code was corrupted by some coupon site, so we had to change it for tracking purposes. But if you enter that code Dunk or go to simplecontacts.com/dunk, you can get $30 off your contacts, and of course let them know that you came from us. That's D-U-N-C. Dunk is the code for this one at Simple Contacts. Oof, it's been so intense with the playoffs. I always kind of just enjoy forgetting for a little while about the crappier teams in the league and just not having to think about them necessarily or watch them for a little bit. But Dennis Smith is one of our favorite players with the Mavs.
Well, let's do the fundamentals.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. No, I guess that's good. It's good to kind of have an idea of how they finish things.
And I actually went through and compiled the end of the season one, so I feel like might as well do that. So Dallas ended the season 24-58, 2-10 in the last bit, well tanked. Ended up winning the coin flip for the third best lottery odds. 22nd in net rating at -3.2, 24th in offense, a still shocking 16th in defense. And I'm intrigued by where they go, but also a part of this kind of before we get into Dennis Smith is this is not a particularly young team, especially if you consider it the way that we did, where guys who are still young in terms of age but have been in the NBA for a while, like Nerlens Noel, like Harrison Barnes, don't really count for this sort of young prospect.
Yeah, I don't think we need to discuss Noel, especially since his body of work was so limited this season. And you're right, I mean, they don't have a ton. Smith was really the first pick that they've had. Remember, they gave up their pick in the Rondo deal. I think that actually ended up being Gershon Yabusele, which not all draft picks work out. In 2016, they had Justin Anderson in 2015. He's not on the team anymore, so it's basically just been guys that they found at the minimum outside of Dennis Smith. So he's the main guy. The numbers were not amazing in terms of his efficiency. 47% true shooting, that is of course god awful. The league average is around 55-56% these days. It's a little bit lower for guards certainly, but that is an unacceptable number. It is nearly impossible to help your team offensively with that type of true shooting. Maybe if you're a Ricky Rubio type of player, is just amazing passing vision, which although Smith I think has underrated vision, he's not anywhere near at that level. But I thought he really came on towards the end, to the point where they even sat him because they believed that he was hurting their tank, and they had some huge wins at the end against Phoenix, against Orlando. God, those were just incredible games. Thank God it's the playoffs. If you had to say, was Smith above or below your preseason expectations, what would your thought be?
So he was pretty much right on, but I would say if he had to go one direction or the other, I would say a little bit below. Defensively, we knew he would be bad, but he was maybe even worse than anticipated. We talked about this a lot going back to the worst team all defense. He just didn't really play with enough force on that. And then offensively, there were certainly the flashes, the call signs of what could be a dynamic play. Player, but you know, just not seeing a shot fall except for 61% at the rim, you know, I'm okay with that.
That's really, for a rookie point guard, that is really good. Like that is excellent. Now he didn't get to the foul line at all. Like that's something that he really needs to improve his craft there, because his free throw rate only 19%, and for a guy who drives that much, like he's really, especially when you consider too that, you know, he really loves to like get up and dunk on guys. I think sometimes by drawing fouls on those plays you can actually actually reduce the wear and tear, as long as you're not just like crashing into the ground necessarily. You know, if you're just kind of using tricks to draw contact or getting a shove from your defender, feeling contact, throwing up some bullshit, you know, he's got to learn how to do all that. And as fast as he is, you know, I think he can really get there. And I thought his jump shot, just watching it, looked a little bit better. He looked more comfortable. I thought he learned to shoot two-point jumpers as the year went on, to kind of hop into that shot, which was not a shot he really had at NC State. I think it was like, you know, 25% on two-point jumpers at NC State. And so there's nothing wrong with his shot in terms of just watching it. It didn't go in. His shot selection was not good. And maybe he'll never get better as a shooter, but there's a lot of 19-year-old point guards who just shoot a terrible percentage from the field. And I think at least the fact that he's able to get up as many shots as he did with that 28% usage, that's almost encouraging, even if maybe the decision making wasn't unbelievable. And then his turnover rate, 15% is high, but it's not just like so incredibly astronomical. For comparison, but like JJ Barea's was 16%, so it's and that's I think I generally have been higher on him, although I think we're both higher on him than the overall consensus. But I think this was about where I believe that he could be. I don't think there wasn't that much that I was disappointed in. I think, you know, if his usage had been lower and his efficiency were this low, I might feel bad. But, you know, he took a ton of shots and he was able to generate them. And I think that if he becomes more judicious, especially since he shot so well at the rim, that maybe he can get more efficient that way. And I think his shot will go in a little bit more too.
And Dennis Smith is just so explosive that you can see a lot of the other elements getting better. As the Mavericks improve the talent around him, I could see that happening over the next couple of years. And his defensive flaws won't matter as much when they, you know, once they move on from Dirk and can actually kind of go in a more cogent direction there. And if the jump shot, I don't think it's ever going to be like the strength, the centerpiece of his offensive game. But if it can get to a point where teams can't just live by going under on it, that opens up so much more of the rest of Smith's offense.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative right now. The fact that he shot 69% from the line is a little discouraging. He used to be it was a 70% free throw shooter in college, I think like 73% or something. But that I'd like to see a little bit better. That's a data point that might augur against him being as good of a shooter as we hope. But he got up to 31% from threes by the end of the year. You know, there was a point at which he was below that. I think with the shots that he took, I mean, pretty much all of his shots are off the dribble. And to shoot 31%, he was at 6.0 three-point attempts per 36 minutes. And when you compare him, his shooting, to Russell Westbrook or Derrick Rose or John Wall, Wall has more size than him, but some of these other kind of nuclear athletic point guards, he's at a better level than all of them were as rookies. And he's finished at the rim pretty well, you know, about the same level as them. And I think that even compared to Westbrook or Rose, he's got more vision than those guys. Now, he's probably not as good of a player as Rose was as a rookie. Rose was coming into a better team. The one thing I think he also really needs to do, and a lot of this I think is philosophy too, is he's a great transition point guard and the Mavericks just never run. And I don't know whether that's him not pushing it hard enough. I don't know whether that's Rick Carlisle saying, no, you got to slow it down. But I mean, the biggest reason why their offense was below average this year in the half court, they're actually above average. It's just they never, ever run. And so if they could just do more of that, and they have, you know, Dwight Powell, Harrison Barnes, those guys should be able to get out and run a little bit with him. That'd be good. And actually, there's one other thing where I thought he did exceed expectations as well. And he avoided a major injury, which we were concerned about. He played 69 games. He probably, if they hadn't been tanking, probably could have got into the 70s. That's a full season. Essentially, he had some, was plagued by ankle sprains to some degree, had knee soreness where he'd miss a couple games here and there. But the fact that he didn't suffer an injury that was major at all, I think is important as well for his long-term growth, because that was one of the big concerns, is that he'd already had a torn ACL in his past.
You mentioned this, so I looked it up. Smith averaged 4.8 threes per game. This is not per 36 minutes per game. 2.7 of those were pull-ups, so that's a majority, and he shot 27% on those, 27.4 to be specific. And then he took 2.1 catch and shoot, shot 37% on those.
That's interesting. It's actually a lower percentage of off the dribble shots than I might have expected comprising that, but he would play with other point guards at time too. So yeah, I still feel very good about his future. You know, he's been passed by Donovan Mitchell in this draft class, but I still would take him over any of the other other point guards drafted in this draft class as of now. If Markel Fultz rediscovers his jumper, I would change that.
Yeah, if Fultz were 100%, it would be a different case, but I have Smith over Fultz as well, just because of the possibility that never comes. And Smith, I wonder whether he's going to play at all in Summer League this year, just because I would love to see him against that kind of competition again.
I'd be shocked if he did. Why even risk the injury?
I think what will probably happen is he'll be with the team, but he won't.
Yeah, it does seem like one of those. Maybe he'll play a game or two. I hope he does. I enjoy watching him, but it seems foolish, especially with his style. Yeah, I mean, it'll be good for him to be with the team, to practice, to play some defense. But yeah, I mean, no reason to push it there. Talk about some of their other guys very briefly. And really, probably the only other one that's worth discussing much, since Dorian Finney-Smith had only played under 350 minutes this year with he had his own quad tendon issues. Don't ever injure your quad tendon, by the way, apparently. Yogi Ferrell, who was a great story last year, coming in, fueled a mid-season resurgence for a time, played a little bit of a different role. He would play alongside Smith at times, only a 17% usage rate, right about the league average in true shooting. I mean, I think he's been not an amazing distributor. He generally would play, next to a Devin Harris or Smith. I think they even played him with Barea every once in a while, but usually there would be another point guard in the backcourt.
Yeah, they even did the Energizer Bunny combination, which was Ferrell, Harris, and Barea, I believe.
Yeah, with Harris at the three, and as it's against certain teams, you can get away with that type of an alignment, especially off the bench. But Ferrell was never going to be like some big star, even though he had some of those huge games in the middle of last year. He had already started regressing by the end of the last season, but I think he's a guy who could be a quality off the bench type of option. He's not really going to get to the rim very much. He takes only 15% of his shots there. Does shoot a good percentage since he's judicious about his attacks. And from three, 37%, I think we can look at him as a reliable three-point shooter, if not the 40% guy that he was at times last year. And so you can feel pretty good about having him as a backup point guard. Now, he is a restricted free agent this offseason, but I certainly would give him a qualifying offer, and we'll see. I don't see him getting an offer elsewhere, so this could be one of those ones where maybe he comes back for a little bit more money on a two-year deal, something. But I think you could feel okay about him as your backup point guard just in the regular season. In the playoffs, his size could potentially get exploited a little bit, but I don't have that much more to say about him, really. He's not really much of a distributor. Can shoot the ball, can get out in transition a little bit, run a pick and roll. You can't really go under on him, and that's a useful player.
Type of guy you're happy is on your team as long as you're not paying them too much money, and it looks like the Mavericks won't have to pay him too much money, so they're fine. And we should also mention this was his age 24 season.
Yeah, that's worth noting. Smith, of course, is age 20 season, and I don't think we need to talk about their two-way guys, really. I think everybody has seen quite enough of them just from how much they played down the stretch. I don't think I mentioned this on the pod, by the way, but a massive unintended consequence of the two-way contract rule is tanking basketball is like 40% worse than it was previously. Not only because all the teams were together, but like when teams do try to tank, you now have two more roster spots at your disposal to do that, right? It's like it used to be you had to at least play a few real NBA players in these games at the end of the year just to field an 8 or 9 man rotation. You had to at least get like some of your normal rotation guys in there. Now though, with the two-way contracts, and then especially with the fact that once the G League season ends, you can just bring those guys up and their service time, they're not taking away the service time anymore. Now you're starting games with guys 13 through 17 on the roster, and it's just led to some incredibly awful basketball, and also led to Aaron Harrison playing 48 minutes in that last game of the season against the Suns. It's reduced the overall level of play even normally too, because if you think about it, let's say you only have 15 guys on the roster and a bunch of guys get hurt and you have to sign someone to a 10-day or whatever, now you're signing the 451st best guy that's available. But now, because everyone else is under two-way contracts, you're signing the 511th best guy that's available. And that guy is then playing over 60 guys who might be qualified to have that spot, but are already under contract in the G League. So there have been a number number of things about the two-way contract system that I haven't liked that much. And especially, yeah, go
ahead. And another one, as somebody who had to come through all this because of the Quinn Cook stuff, I am a little bit uncomfortable with how much power teams have over two-way guys after 1 year. You know, it's like usually you could get in these circumstances. And so the fact that they only have to tender at a two-way contract, and there's a limitation in that. You can't do it. I think it's only... Well,
there should be something akin to the starter criteria for two-way guys, where you have to give them you have to keep their rights. If they're only on a one-year two-way contract, it's like you have to offer them a required tender of a real NBA contract or have converted them by the summer, where it's because what is the tender for a two-way guy? It's like incredibly cheap, right?
It's another two-way contract. It's $50,000 right. Guaranteed.
And now you can only keep guys on a two-way contract for 2 years, and then you have to either sign them or let them go. But nonetheless, I think, like, if guys, you know, someone like Quinn Cook or CJ Williams or Ty Wallace, like those, if you're actually like starting games or you're playing, you know, you play X number of minutes in the games that you're actually active with the team, or you play a bunch of games after your 45 days is over and you get brought up again, whatever the criteria you could come up with, I'm sure there'd be something fair. You average a certain number of points per minute or whatever it is, you should be able to at least like have that leverage to get a real NBA contract, instead of just like, I played well in the NBA for a year and now I'm forced to sign the Hinkie special because you have this type of leverage over me.
And these players, generally speaking, you know, you could say, oh, well, they can get an offer in restricted free agency. Well, restricted free agency is already screwed in favor of the prior team against the free agent themselves, because they didn't fix the timeline issues and all that. And the prospect of making a commitment, probably using some of your mid-level exception or something like that, to sign a former two-way guy, it could happen in narrow cases, but it's a lot to ask. So throwing them into that pool is even more limited.
Yeah, it actually wouldn't shock me if we saw more restricted free agent offer sheets to two-way guys, because you can just use the minimum exception for that, and it's probably something that they would actually sign. And you'd think, hey, this guy's on a two-way. The team didn't even offer, you know, didn't bother to convert him until now, so we might actually be able to get this guy. There might be a feeling that just, hey, he's not in the other guy in the team's plans. But generally, if a guy has played well enough to have played a bunch of games, unless he's on Dallas and they're trying to tank their asses off, you're probably just going to get matched on that anyway. You really would have to like pull out some diamonds in the rough on a team that doesn't have any roster slots or has a lot of guys at that position, or you just love the way they played in the G League or whatever. And so if they're at that level, giving them guaranteed money in an offer sheet, and also, by the way, a restricted free agent offer sheet still has to be 2 years, so you're now giving them 2 years. You're right, the whole system is kind of messed up. I think that'll do it for today, though. Anything you wanted to talk about before we go, though?
Well, I will mention, because we didn't talk about Warriors Spurs yesterday, that I wrote a piece for The Athletic on basically the preliminary idea, obviously it's not settled yet, of what a Warriors Pelican series could look like, kind of some broad scope ideas. And I should have a series of pieces coming out for The Athletic soon, one on the teams with cap space this summer. I actually went through and redid the numbers now that we have a lot of the draft order set. Obviously can change with what happens in the lottery. And then offseason previews, I have the first four written. I do not know what order they're going to be released, but those are going to start rolling out. And I also started writing something for Real GM, which is not yet done. That'll probably be done the next couple days, which will be a Danny story time on Patreon.
All right, Twitter NBA show Wednesday. We will, of course, have a pod tomorrow on the games, but we will not be live since we'll be in Oakland for that Warriors Spurs Titanic tilt in person. Talk to you all tomorrow night.